Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Just to remind you, and you'll be able to check on the PRN website, we're making some big schedule changes in March, and programs are going to be switched around. There'll be new programs. This program, Occupied Territory, starting the first week in March, will be on, and that is starting March 1st, and thereafterwards, the first week in March, this program will be on Thursdays at 1 p.m., not on Wednesdays. And my show on Thursdays, The Turning Point, if any of you listen to that, will be switched to Monday afternoon. So I won't get into this because it's too complicated for now, but there are changes coming up, which I will continue to announce, and you'll hear some promos on the air, and you can check the website too. But so for instance, next week, because of the odd date change, I will be doing Occupy Territory twice next week. Don't ask me, but that's the way it worked out. Also, when it comes to this program, I would love everybody, as I say every week, to participate in our Facebook page, the Occupied Territory Facebook page. To do that, just Google Occupied Territory and Facebook. That'll get you there. Occupied Territory and Facebook will get you to our page, and there's postings of videos, there's opinion stuff, there's book reviews, and discussions between people. So please join in. I think, let's see, what else did I want to tell you about? Yes. If you wanted to call today, the number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And, you know, I come from the old school radio, which is sort of interactive before there was interactive internet. So I like people calling up. If you want to call up, do that. Also, you can tweet us here at PRN, at PRN underscore radio. Okay, so we're going to have a guest on today and talk about an interesting concept. And well, he's with us now. You know, there's a minimum wage, which, of course, is nowhere near what it needs to be for us to actually live a decent life in this country or anybody who's getting it. But there is a proposal that people have. That it's been something that's been in American history. It's been in American politics, been in American life before. It comes and goes, seems to disappear. It gets always labeled communistic or socialistic or evil or something. But there's something called a maximum wage. And today we have somebody, a guest on, who's going to talk about that. Sam Pizzicati, you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sam is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. He edits Too Much, which is, would you call it, an online weekly magazine?
Yes, it's an online weekly. People can sign up and get it via email each week.
Yeah, I just did that today. So everybody sign up for this. It's called Too Much. Just go to Institute for Policy Studies and Too Much, and you can sign up for it. And it's an online weekly magazine on excess and inequality right away. The alarm bells are going off over, you know, whatever. Anyhow, Sam has a new book coming out after the elections in November, and it's going to be called The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy, 1900 to 1970, that created the classic American middle class. So Sam is a veteran labor journalist and has written widely on economic inequality for both popular and scholarly readers. And his most recent book was Greed and Good, Understanding and Overcoming the Inequality That Limits Our Lives. So right away, you could see, and if you know the Institute for Policy Studies, you could see where Sam stands on this. And he's written an article which is about this concept of a maximum wage. What I what I'm interested in is this is not the first time. I mean, it's not because suddenly we're in a new age of Obama's socialism or whatever pop, you know, vision people have about these things. It's not because of Joe the plumber or anything. This is an old thing in America, right?
It's a very old thing. It goes back to the late 1800s, which was the first time in American history that we saw incredible concentrations of income and wealth, concentrations that mimic what we have today. What we call that period in the late 1800s, the Gilded Age. And some people talk about today as a new Gilded Age. Well, in that first Gilded Age, we had people who called for caps on income and wealth. They said that we cannot maintain our democracy if we continue to allow these vast accumulations of a private fortune to dot the American landscape.
Now, this is something that goes back even further than that, and there are people that understood this from the very beginning of this country, I think, right?
That's right. When we go back to the generation of 1776, there was a real commitment there to moderate the distribution of income and wealth. Those folks in the generation of 1776, they had studied the histories of former republics back through history, mm-hmm. all the way back to Roman times. And their conclusion from their study of that history is that whenever you allowed wealth to accumulate, a republican form of government just could not survive. So one of the first things that that generation of 1776 did after independence was to go after the laws from English common law that allowed rich people to pass their fortunes to the oldest son. Mm-hmm. And they went after those laws because that was a subsidy for the concentration of income and wealth that they thought had to be destroyed.
Well, then we get into here everything starts to mix together, religion and government intrusion and everything. For instance, even though some of the founders felt this way very strongly, and they saw it clearly by studying history, they couldn't actually put anything in the Constitution or in amendments to the Constitution that restricted, you know, wealth. I mean, there is no economic dictate there. And also the other thing is, what fascinates me is that when you go all the way back to the beginning of this country, at least in terms of its white inhabitants and the people who settled here, you know, not the native population, but when they first came here, they call it the Commonwealth of
That's
Massachusetts.
Right.
I'm fascinated that they called it the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And in a way, that was a kind of original Christian idea.
That's right, and of course, when you look back at the Bible and you look back at the ancient prophets in the Bible, what were the prophets railing against? Well, one of the main things they were railing against in biblical times was the concentration of income and wealth in their societies.
I know at the beginning of your article here, and I don't know if this is the title you give it. Sometimes I read things on alternate. It says here, "Runaway greed is destroying America. Should there be a lid on how much someone can make?" Was that your title?
No.
Okay.
It wasn't, but it does speak to the subject of the article.
Well, now you're starting off and you say social decency, most Americans today would agree, demands a minimum wage. But if you're saying that, and certainly I would say that, and most people I know would agree with that, but that is not a way, that's not the way apparently that a lot of people, for instance, if you take one whole party that's running now, all these primaries and the Republicans, I don't always want to label one party or the other, right? But they don't seem to agree on that at all. For instance, one of their candidates, now washed out, Michelle Bachmann, said there shouldn't be a minimum wage. You know, if you ask them and they extended their arguments about, trickle down and, you know, greed is good or whatever, it makes everybody rise. But they would believe that a minimum wage actually interferes with, or a living, let's call it a living wage, interferes with the ability of growth in the country.
That's certainly right. We certainly do not have a total 100% consensus in this country that a minimum wage represents social decency, but we do have overwhelming public opinion in support of the idea of a minimum wage. And every time this has come up as an election issue, those who have gone against the idea of a minimum wage have had their fingers burned.
Well, what's a minimum wage right now? The minimum wage right now is absurd if you want to try to live anything like or even approaching a decent life, right? I mean, a minimum wage should be at least starting around $20 an hour, right?
Well, it's interesting that right now we have a situation where the more people at the top of our economic ladder exploit people at the bottom, the more money they make. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that people who are talking about the idea of a maximum wage are saying is that if we linked a minimum wage to a maximum wage, that is, if we set the maximum wage as a multiple of the minimum wage, then those the richest and most powerful people in our society would have a vested personal interest in improving the well-being of the people at the bottom of our society. Because if the maximum wage were tied to the minimum wage, then the only way the maximum wage could rise would be if the minimum wage rose first.
And can you give me an example of how that would work in terms of, let's say, somebody owns a business or a corporation, or just give me some examples about this?
Sure. The easiest way for it to work would be through the tax system. And that is establish a 100% top tax bracket. All income over a certain point would face a 100% federal tax. And that point could be set as a multiple of the minimum wage. You could say that the top tax bracket would begin at 100 times the minimum wage, so that if people at the top above that that top limit in that top bracket wanted to have keep more of their income, mm-hmm. then the minimum wage would have to rise, because then the maximum wage as 100 times the minimum would be higher too. So the threshold for that top tax bracket would rise as the minimum wage rose.
Okay, so there's their incentive, because that's what Republicans and other people who go on about this all the time talk about. So what's the incentive to make all this money? You know, now we're wandering into Ayn Rand territory, right? What's the incentive to make all this money, after all, if you're going to tax people so badly? Well, if you tie it to the minimum wage, then everything does rise. But maybe you can tell me, is it too simplistic to say that there's no way that people can be very, very rich without a lot of people being very poor? It certainly appears that way, and I know very little about economics. Is that essentially true?
Yes. In a one-word answer, yes. The right wing argues vociferously, of course, that the wealth of the people at the top has nothing to do with the poverty of the people at the bottom. But if we look at societies around the world, those with the poorest poor are also those with the richest rich. Mm-hmm. And in societies where you have more equality, you don't have those vast divides that separate people at the bottom from people at the top.
Now, a couple of times in this country, and they had to do with, and lots of things happened during wartime, for instance, a lot of civil rights get suspended, the Constitution goes by the board, but one thing that happens during wartime, and certainly it happened during the Depression and then during World War II, it happened even during World War I, where suggestions were made that it would happen, is that since we're all making these sacrifices, that this kind of people were looking at a kind of 100% tax over a certain point, or a maximum wage, right?
Yes, and in fact, a president of the United States was looking at that. Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1942 mm-hmm. Proposed a 100% tax on all individual income over $25,000. Now, $25,000 in 1942 would equal around between $325,000 and $350,000 today. Roosevelt said all income over that point should be subject to a 100% tax. Now, Congress didn't go along with that, but Congress did put into effect a 94% top tax rate on income over $200,000.
Now, presumably, this is because there was a war going on. As soon as there wasn't a war going on, well, the top tax rate did stay around for a while. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. I mean, it went straight through.
Yes, and in fact, right after World War II, you had economic thinkers, you had political thinkers saying that it was important to the continued prosperity of the United States to keep that top tax rate at a high level. And it did stay at a high level. It stayed at 91% until 1964. And that period, that 20 years after World War II, was the classic age of middle-class prosperity in the United States.
And so as far as you're concerned, it's directly tied to that, right?
I think there's a clear link. There were two institutions in mid-20th century America that served as the bedrock for the growth of the American middle class. One was steeply graduated progressive income tax rates, and the other was the presence of a strong labor movement throughout the society. So you had the labor movement push up incomes at the bottom, and you had a strong progressive tax system sort of pushed down on high incomes from the top.
Here's something that it's in a way it's very inspiring. I mean, after all, this program is called Occupied Territory. It's devoted to the whole Occupy movement, and certainly they've, when people keep saying, at this point it's absurd to keep saying, what do they want or what's their goal? It's all very clear unless you're deciding not to pay attention to what they're saying on purpose.
Right.
I mean, their goal is that there's too much income inequality and there's too much money. In politics. So the goals are very clear, but this is something from your article here. This is a pledge that some people signed during, you're talking about Felix Adler, who was one of the founders of the Society for Ethical Culture, and he called for an income maximum, widespread income maximum and taxes over 100%. And there was a pledge that was signed, and the people who signed this pledge for this to go into effect, they said they wanted to further the prompt enactment into law of the boldest tax the rich proposal any American political group had ever promoted. They were demanding a fixed limit on income, what the committee would call a conscription of wealth. And this is what is inspiring, what fascinates me here, is, and what's so true. And here's a quote. If the government has a right to confiscate one man's life for public purposes, i.e. the draft or conscription, Committee on War Finance Chairman Amos Pinchot, a progressive New York attorney, declared, it certainly ought to have the right to confiscate another man's wealth for the same purposes. Now, that makes sense, right?
Yes, and that was an incredibly popular pitch at the time. Before World War I started, the top income tax rate was only 15%. That is, multimillionaires, they did not pay more than 15% of any dollar of income in federal taxes. By the end of World War I, the top rate was 79%. And the reason it shot up like that was because of the strong movement led by people like Amos Pinchot for a conscription of wealth.
But history seems to repeat itself. Like, for instance, as soon as World War I is over, then you get, the advent of Hoover, you get the Red Scares, you get Palmer raids. All of a sudden we're chasing the Reds out of the country, right? Because they're to blame for all this, you know. It shifted somehow.
That's right. That happened after World War One, and it almost happened after World War Two. We had a Red Scare after World War Two, which was every bit as ferocious as the Red Scare after World War One. But there was a difference, and the difference was that after World War Two, the United States faced a strong rival in the global diplomatic game, and that of course was the Soviet Union, and the leaders in the United States, corporate leaders in the United States, realized that they could never be victorious in the war for hearts and minds around the world. Mm-hmm. If they did the sorts of things that business leaders did after World War I, that is, crush unions and cleanse the tax code of steeply graduated tax rates.
Oh, well, also lock everybody up, deport people, anybody who even...
Right. So you had that realization. So there were enlightened corporate business leaders after World War II who refused to go the way of the 1920s, who refused to attack unions, who refused to attack the progressive income tax system. And as a result, with those high tax rates on the rich stayed in effect after World War II, labor unions were able to function after World War II in a way that they were not allowed to function after World War One, and we had the middle class prosperity that we eventually had.
You know, if you look at what's happening right now, now of course the Democrats and the Republicans, I mean the entire government machinery, which is basically controlled by money, and that includes the Democrats. We're now in a state of quote unquote permanent war against enemies within and without, which is an excuse, of course, always to do whatever they want to do, and. But I, during World War II, didn't they have just not only just taxes over a certain amount, but they also had lids. There were caps on what you could charge for certain things, like basics,
yes,
right?
Yes.
That's because
yes.
there was a war on.
The OPA, the Office of Price Administration, was the federal agency that supervised a very vast system of price controls throughout the economy. And there were also wage controls throughout the economy as well. There were benchmarks that collective bargaining were... People who engaged in collective bargaining were encouraged not to surpass. And one of the interesting things out of World War II is our whole pension system grew up at that time because the pensions were not covered by those wage controls. So unions negotiated pensions for their members in lieu of wage increases.
Oh, so that's what they got as a reward for being patriotic citizens and not pushing higher demands during the war.
That's right.
So, but what for instance? Were what kind of caps were on what kind of things during World War II? I'm interested. Do you know?
All sorts of daily consumer goods were under price controls.
I think in New York City weren't there rent controls?
That's right. Rent controls had started a little bit before World War II, but during World War II they came into in effect in a very strong way throughout the country, and in New York City they remained in effect after World War II, and were another important building block of middle class security.
So now you get a situation like, you know, we're not in an actual world war like we were those two times. Well, actually, I don't even count World War I. That was some sort of trumped up excursion that I don't even want to talk about right at the moment. It's too complicated. But World War II, yes, an actual world war. But now we're in a state, quote unquote, of permanent war against the terrorists, right? Which seems to be an excuse to do all sorts of things. Now, I notice it's interesting when we're talking about caps on prices. I mean, after all, we can put a higher tax on the rich. We can make the corporate people pay up. We can raise the minimum wage, and we can reinforce unions, which were being under attack all over the country. But it would be interesting to see some price controls, because now basically people are making less and less relative to the way things cost all the time, and the costs never go down, but wages, real wages and real income, goes down. For instance, what's interesting to me right now is the price of gas has gone up. Right? And
yes.
I'm sure that it has no basis in reality except for the reality of greed. I mean, that's my guess. You know.
Right. Well, there are a number of factors behind rising energy prices, gasoline prices, and one of them is commodity speculation.
Well, yeah.
Asset bubbles in the commodity markets, and asset bubbles, wherever they appear, are driven by concentrations of income and wealth, by economic realities where people who need to have purchasing power don't have it, and people who don't need the purchasing power have too much. There's no other than speculation. There's no reasonable place for people to invest, and you get asset bubbles.
During right around, let's say, World War II, or right afterwards, in the 50s or something like that, what was the ratio of what a corporate CEO was making to an average worker, as compared to now?
Between 20 and 30 times what their average workers were making.
And now?
At that time. And now it's the latest count that we put together this past September was 325 times to one. So in other words, the gap has increased tenfold.
Well, now, see, let's go back to the beginning of your essay. By the way, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Sam Pizzagatti, and he is the editor of a weekly online magazine, which is, I guess it's part of the Institute for Policy Studies?
Yes, it's a publication of the Institute, and people can go to it. If you just Google too much, you'll go straight to it.
That's good. Too much, all right. Too much, and you might, I did that earlier, and I got a lot of too muches, too much this, too much pizza, you know, but you got to be careful on the Internet, so but too much, maybe an Institute for Policy Studies. But here's a question I want to ask you. You start out your essay saying social decency. You use the word social decency to start out the essay.
Yes.
But when you have what seems to be accepted by a lot of people or not argued about by a lot of people or the mass of people, 325 times the CEO's pay to the average worker's pay, there's I hate to use this word because it sounds old-fashioned. That's not decent. It's immoral. So the question is, here's the question, and there's actually a question involved here. What happened? Where did it get off the track that we went backwards to like the 1880s or something? How do we go so far back? Where do we lose the idea of what's decent and what's moral between people who could be so rich and a lot of people who don't have anything?
Well, of course, it wasn't an overnight turn of events, but the events did start to turn at the end of the 1960s and the beginning of the 1970s, and essentially, the global event that changed it was recovery from World War II on the part of Western Europe and Japan. Before the 1970s, the United States essentially totally dominated the global economy. Over half of the manufactured goods in the world were coming from the United States. You know, the United States was the colossus. And at that time, it was easy to be a U.S. businessman because you just didn't have much competition around the world. In the 1970s, that changed. Japan recovered. Western Europe recovered. There was real competition in the global marketplace, and corporate America faced a choice at that time, and the choice was, how were they going to compete? Were they going to compete by becoming more efficient, more innovative, more creative? Were they going to tap the wisdom of their workers more? Were they going to train their workforces so their companies would be more efficient? That would be taking the high road to competition. Mm-hmm. Or would they take the low road? Would they attack workers' wages? Would they attack workers' benefits? Would they try to squeeze consumers at every opportunity? And that's essentially what they did. They decided to take the the low road. And so for the past 30 odd years, we've had this retreat from the United States of the mid 20th century, a retreat from equality and a movement toward greater equality, inequality, rather in our society.
So in a way, based on what you're telling me there, you can almost interpret it as all these rough, tough businessmen and stand alone and make it on your own actually took the cowardly route out. They just picked on people who were more helpless instead of actually going out in the world and really competing like they say everybody should, right?
I hadn't heard that way of referring to it before, but that's a very good way of referring to it. It was a cowardly way out.
Well, so finally we have here, the first time I've seen since the 60s, people pouring out on the streets, not as many as I'd like to see, but I'm counting on the spring coming now and seeing a lot more people. We have the Occupy movement, which I believe is going to flare up 10 times, 100 times larger in the spring for all sorts of reasons, considering also that's a political convention year and all these things are coming to a head. But it seems to the whole idea of the Occupy movement's point has penetrated everywhere. I mean, I don't know how it was expressed yesterday, what the context was. Apparently, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase said something about reducing the amount of money that the rich make and that kind of thing. In other words, it has penetrated the Occupy movement's point.
Yes, it's incredible. It's wonderfully gratifying to see what the Occupy movement has been able to accomplish in just what's about 6 months now. Yeah. There's been a real sea change in U.S. political discourse, and it's all the work of the Occupy movement.
I think finally we're going to move on to another segment here, but I think finally do we have a call? Do we still have that call? Yeah, we've got a caller on the line. Do you want to see who we've got here? Yeah,
sure.
Go ahead. Caller, go ahead. You're on.
Am I on?
Yes, you're on. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I wanted to ask your guest, what does he think of this emotionally disturbed people that are hoarders? And throughout history, hoarding has always been an issue, and I think we just don't look at it because our sense of security is placed on stuff.
I'm not sure how that works. I would say that hoarding is, it certainly is a mental illness, but if it is, it's a societal mental illness in the United States. Let me ask you one last question. Sam, you know, the president gets on all the time, and politicians get on all the time, and they always make this qualification in this very sort of pleasant way, as if it's something that everybody accepts and understands. Well, first of all, let me back up a little bit. They say the president is always talking about the American dream. And we're constantly hearing talk on and during political campaigns. After that, forget about it, right? But during the campaigns, when they have to appeal to real voters, they're talking about the American dream. And what is that? The American dream, oh, you know, it's a nice house someplace in the suburbs, a decent job with a good wage where your kids, you know, can have some of the benefits of life. I'm not sure if that really is the American dream. I think the American dream is to be as rich as possible. So let me ask you this question. Is there anything, do you see anything immoral about people actually being rich? I mean, in a society where people have to live together in this world and share a limited number of things like, you know, fuel and food and whatever it is, land. Is there any moral value at all that you could ever attach anymore to actually being rich? I mean, is it wrong to be rich?
Again, in a word, yes. It is wrong to have excessive amounts of income and wealth in some people's pockets. It is wrong to have a society where 1% of the population has over 20% of the income, has over 40% of the wealth. We're not going to have a society of total equality, and nobody is promoting that idea, but the other extreme, having a society where we have incredible accumulations, private accumulations of wealth, is not good for society. It's not good for the physical or mental health of a society. And the work of epidemiologists, which are scientists who study the health of populations, they've showed over the past 30 years through a wonderful body of research that the more unequal societies become, the more income and wealth concentrated in a society, the less the quality of life in that society for everyone in it, both the poor, the people in the middle, and people at the upper end. If we want to have decent societies, we have to have reasonable distributions of income and wealth.
Well, I'm sure people who are at the very upper end, somebody like Mr. Romney or maybe even Mr. Obama, who have tens of millions of dollars, they might think that the quality of their life was okay. I really would like to see the president get up one time, but wouldn't we all like to see him get up one time and do about 100 things we thought he would do? But I'd like to see him get up one time and say, I don't begrudge people their wealth. I'd like him to get up and say what you just said, but that's not going to happen. Anyhow. All right, so it's you know, it's called Too Much, and that's the online magazine connected to the Institute for Policy Studies, and this is Sam Pizzicati, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay. Let's take a little bit of a break here, and then we'll be back. Okay, this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, and once again, I urge you all, I would force you all if I could do it, you know? If I had the presidential authority, I would draft you all. Do I have democratic instincts? I don't know if I have democratic, I think I have dictatorship instincts. I fight against them, though, and that's the point. But I urge you all to go to our Facebook page, Occupied Territory Facebook page. There's, you know, it's winter for a long time now. Now it's spring. In fact, it's an artificially, because of global warming, an artificially early spring. But let's take advantage of it. Things are now heating up again. Things are cooking up again. Occupy Wall Street and all the other Occupy movements throughout the country and various outgrowths and various assemblages are taking place again. And they're going to be much larger. They're going to be much bigger and much more effective than they were before, I feel. I know there were plenty effective before because they've changed the shape of what people think and how they speak in this country. The whole idea of income equality. And the Republicans have the constant phrase now, which is trite already, but it's called double down. You know how phrases come into being, like sometimes and they last for a couple of months and then they disappear. This is a new one called Double Down. Well, essentially what the Republicans are doing right now, and the Democrats being bought and sold the way they are, aren't too far behind, but what the Republicans are really doing, they're out in front. They make a religious faith out of it is, for instance, Rick Santorum said the other day, income equality is good for America. The whole idea of what he calls competition, that every, you know, that the weak will fall by the wayside and the strong will survive. This has nothing to do with his alleged Christianity. It actually makes him into a total hypocrite and the corrupt bastard that he actually is. And anybody who thinks that way, anybody who identifies himself as a Christian and can say at the same time that there should be income inequality. Anybody who identifies himself as a Christian and makes close to $1 million a year, which is when Santorum made last year, is not really a Christian. He's a hypocrite. And they're all corrupt. And all this talk about social values and Christianity and every last one of these people is corrupt. And they're full of it. If you get me somebody, find me somebody who lives in a hut somewhere or in an old shack someplace who preaches Christianity and what, and he raises food and he shares it with everybody and he hardly has any himself because he gives it to all the poor people in his immediate neighborhood. And then he gets on and talks about, Christianity. I'll listen to him. But do not ever listen to these people talking about Christianity, people who are rich. The simplest thing in the New Testament says, the rich can no more enter heaven than a camel can pass through the eye of a needle. Did they forget that part? Did they forget the part that Jesus came to earth for poor people? Did they forget the part where the rich people are supposed to give all they have to the poor if they want to enter the kingdom of heaven? And that was a metaphor to having a decent, meaningful, worthwhile life. Did they forget all that? The whole New Testament, or the whole gospel of Jesus, I should say, the whole gospel of Jesus, forget about the rest of the New Testament, that was all PR, propaganda, and witch burning, and Revelations is an LSD trip, but that's another story. But the gospels of Jesus, if you read them, the bulk of the gospels of Jesus are completely diametrically opposed to any of the statements and the lives led by the people who propose themselves as Christians now, who run for office in this country, or who actually have high office in this country. This Occupy movement, anytime you find a group of people that at least says, if not actually practices, the idea of sharing equally anything, that is the original Christianity. It's the way it was. It's what was said in the Bible. It's what Jesus said. It's the way the early Christian communities practiced. They practiced what was preached. And everything has gone downhill since then. I mean, look at the Catholic Church, the worst possible example of the corruption of Christianity. And then you look at these crazy, insane, hypocritical Christians in this country, all of whom, the ones who are the most strident preachers of lift yourself up by your bootstraps, and if you're poor, well, that's the way God meant it to be, and if you can't take care of yourself, I'm not going to take care of you, and yes, I have a lot, but I have a God-given right to have a lot. All of this is utter hypocrisy and nonsense. I don't know where they get this from. It's self-justifying ignorance. I don't know, it set me off on that, but when you see a group like Occupy, when you see a group of people who attempt to share things in common, who attempt to, whatever they have that comes to them, they attempt to share it with other people, who reach out to help other people who are downtrodden, that is real Christianity. That's what I see it as. That's what I see as real Christianity. But you're not seeing that anywhere. And I'm not just picking on the Republicans either. The Occupy movement has it right. They set themselves against any corporation or any politician, left, right, or center, who is mealy-mouthed, who is hypocritical, and sets money above everything else. 95% of the Democrats and the Republicans in state legislatures and in Congress, the Republicans and the Democrats, all of them, are owe their lives and owe their fortunes, and a lot of them are millionaires, owe their fortunes to big money. They don't owe it to our votes. Yeah, we elected them so that they could pump their offices, you know, for all the money that was underneath it. I mean, like an oil well or something. They use their offices. I mean, how did Santorum get rich? How does anybody get rich? I mean, here, for instance, and I don't want to just be picking on the Republicans. Occupy has it right. Go after everybody and make the point. There was a big article in the Times the other day about front page article about the man who is the man who is running President Obama's re-election campaign. His name is David Plouffe. It's pronounced Plouffe. And he is supposed to be, you know, he's his razor. He's his hitman, his assassin, right? Every president, no matter how much he smiles and shakes hands and talks about the good of the people and, you know, the common man like Obama and all the rest of them do, they all have people in the background who will hit you over the head and steal your wallet and, you know, run you right over in their car to get you elected again. These are the people who go off. Now we have super PACs. But they, every one of them has got a right-hand sort of like hitman. And David Plouffe is, his name is spelled P-L-O-U-F-F-E. He is the president's hitman. He's the man who got him elected, one of the men who got him elected last time. And he's the man who is running his presidential campaign again. And David Plouffe, who is running the president's campaign, has a job. I don't know how much he gets paid. I'm sure it's a hell of a lot more than all of you get paid and than I get paid. He has a job in the White House. He has an office in the White House as an advisor to the president. But his real job, his only job, is to make sure that whatever the president does and whatever the president says gets him reelected. He is working for President Obama. He is working for Barack Obama. He is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Barack Obama Corporation. He is an employee of Barack Obama, not President Obama, not our president, not the president. And this man is getting paid with our tax money in the White House, right? And here's an interesting thing. Let me tell you about him, right? And this is the guy who's the president's right-hand man, who's actually his closest advisor, according to a lot of people, closer than anybody else. And basically, he's a man who's getting him, who's working to get him reelected. Not a man who's working to get whatever policies Mr. Obama says he wants to do for you and me, to uplift us, to make our lives better, to make the air cleaner, to get us more of a decent wage, to make sure that the banks don't rape and kill us. He doesn't care about that. It says here, if Mr. Plouffe has an ideological bent other than being a Democrat, it is not evident. Here's a quote. I don't know that he has a passion for the middle class or the environment or whatever it is, said Steve Elmendorf, a Democratic lobbyist and close friend. He has a passion for winning and a passion for putting together the operation to do so. So that's the guy that your tax dollars and my tax dollars are paying to sit in the White House and advise the president, right? And here's Mr. Plouffe. Now, he got him elected in 2008, right? Let's see. He is considered the prime facilitator in Washington for those seeking to monetize, get that? I love this word, monetize their political service, i.e., like Santorum and Gingrich and all these people. They make millions of dollars off the fact that they were senators or are senators or were Speaker of the House. They use their position as public servants paid by our tax money to get rich, right? Okay, so Plouffe is a guy. This is the guy who works for President Obama, right? Mr. Smiley Face, who loves us all. He helps people monetize their political service. They're talking about Mr. Barnett, who is an associate of a lawyer, Robert Barnett. And so between the time when he got Obama elected and now when he's helping him get elected again, negotiated with a lawyer to represent him. And Mr. Plouffe is getting a seven-figure book advance and sent him out on speaking gigs. Mr. Plouffe earned $1.5 million in 2010, according to White House disclosure statements, which included management consulting work, get this now, for Boeing and General Electric. Now, remember, Newt was a historian for for Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, or Fannie Mac and Freddie Mae, or whatever those hillbilly names are. Newt was a historian. He wasn't a lobbyist. He was a historian. So Mr. Plouffe here, while working for Mr. Obama, I guess he took a little time off. Maybe he moved, you know, down the road or something. He did management consulting work for Boeing and General Electric, and close to $500,000 he got for speeches around the world, including $100,000 from MTN Nigeria, an African telecommunications firm. You know, that's it. That's it, boys and girls. You know, you want to make money? Don't go into business. Don't go into sports. Don't go into music. It's hit or miss there. You got to have a little talent. You got to be able to put the ball in the basket. You got to hit the right note. You know, you want to hit oil? Yeah, maybe if you're lucky. the way, the guaranteed, absolute guaranteed way to make a lot of money in this country, go into politics, right? Go into politics and you can monetize it, babe. You can monetize it all the way to the bank. That's how it works. That's what the Occupy movement is here to tell us. And things are happening. Things are happening. And one of the great proofs to me recently that the Occupy movement is having an effect is that they recently had their, the Republicans, conservative Republicans recently had their giant, their giganto, prove you're the best conservative meeting in Washington, their giant convention of CPAC, the action committee, you know, the conservative political action committee. And all about money and Ayn Rand and, you know, making money and everything like that. And keeping the poor down, keeping the rich up, because it'll be good for everybody, right? Meanwhile, at the very end of CPAC, which concluded last weekend, there was a huge auditorium full of people, and there was a panel discussion about modern, you know, movements and what's going on, the Tea Party, this, Occupy that. And somebody said, what do you believe in? The Occupy movement? Boos! Boos are registered all across the auditorium. Or the Tea Party. And everybody in this auditorium stood up. In other words, these piddly little, you know, roaches who want to eat everybody and get rich and fat and call it in the name of free market capitalism theology that they made up. These people who really are just selfish people, and they don't care what happens to anybody else. They're scared. They are finally scared. So it's required in their psyche as a defense for them to stand up and give giant rousing cheers until they had to be told to quiet down and sit down again for the Tea Party, right? Because they finally understand, and everybody finally understands who studied anything about the Tea Party, and I can tell you a lot more about the Tea Party because I'm on a lot of their mailing lists. They don't care who it is, right? You just click on, yes, I want to be part of the movement to free America from socialism, and right away your mailbox is full of their trash. And I get all their announcements. So I get all the Occupy announcements, and I get all the, you know, I get the NRA. You know, do you want your children to be safe? Then don't let the president get away with his socialistic theories. I get all this stuff all day long. So they find it necessary to encourage their own fears, you know, to cover up their own fears by cheering the Tea Party. The Tea Party is an empty-headed, hollow shell. If it was ever anything, it was soon inhabited, almost like a pod, like the pod people. It was soon inhabited by aliens or possessed by demons called the very rich. The very rich, from the beginning of the Tea Party, they have occupied the Tea Party. The rich have been occupying the Tea Party, speaking of occupying movements. The Tea Party is a meaningless group of ignorant people who have lost their way. They wear funny hats, they carry muskets around, and they talk about don't let the government intrude on anything. They don't want any government intrusion on anything. And especially they don't want government intrusion when it comes to corporations making money and corporations doing whatever they want and rich people earning as much money as they want. By the way, the Tea Party and the Republicans, they don't mind at all if the government intrudes on women's bodies. You know, the government of the state of Virginia can do ultrasounds now and interfere with women's most private parts, to use a radio phrase, right? And basically commit legal rape, you know, with an instrument because they want to discourage women having abortions. They want to discourage women having abortions. So they do this basically what is nothing less than legal rape with devices. And this is the government of Virginia, right? Virginia is very right-wing, very conservative now. This stuff is going on all over the country. They're such hypocrites, these people. They're such hypocrites. They don't want the government to ever intrude on anything that has to do with money, but they won't leave you alone for a second. They're like witch burners when it comes to women's bodies, when it comes to your social mores, when it comes to your practices, when it comes to your sexual practices. They won't leave you alone. They want the government to intrude the way the government intruded in Salem, Massachusetts, or in the 1500s in England, where they burned people at the stake for saying they didn't like the king, or that they didn't believe in the Pope as the supreme prelate and Bishop of God. This is the way they are. Santorum is nothing but a witch burner. But what makes it even more difficult and what makes it even more subtle and hard, and why you need the Occupy movement to be flagrant and to stay outside. I'm convinced, finally, the Occupy movement has to stay outside of any kind of Democratic or Republican structure. It would be good if the unions went along with them, but they have to stay outside, almost like an outlaw group, like pirate radio was once upon a time. If they get connected with any of these people, they're going to lose their force. It's like being an apple in a barrel full of rotten apples. They got to stay outside. So the point of it is there is too much money in politics. There is too much income inequality. They are called communists. They are called socialists by people who don't know any better and people who do know better. The people who are really rich want to stir up the rabble. They want to stir up all these poor schleps who believe in wearing wigs and carrying muskets around and saying, don't tread on me, and that the government should stay out of people's lives. If the government stayed out of people's lives the way they wanted to, you would have a hydro-fracking well underneath your house right now. When you turn the water on, it would go on fire if you set a match to it. You would breathe air that would poison you the minute you took one breath of it and fall down. If they could get away with what they want to get away with, that would be the end of you. I mean, you would drop down dead. So that's their whole idea. And why is this? Because corporations and rich people, as we see from the super PACs, have almost complete control over the politics and the government of our country. Almost complete control. Something like a handful of people, 12, 25 people, have contributed more than $50 million in the last few months. $50 million to the people just on the Republican side that are running for president. And the president of the United States goes to dinners where they spend $33,500 a plate, right? So, and he talks about, and then he gets out and he makes speeches about the common man. We all need to stop being stupid. The biggest problem in this country is not money, it's not the environment, it's not global warming. The biggest problem in the world, but especially in America, because I'm an American and that's what I'm concerned about, is stupidity. People are so goddamn stupid. They need to wise up. And I'm not, you know, I know all of you who are listening to me aren't like that, or you wouldn't be listening to me. I know I'm not like that. I know my engineer is not like that. I know my program director is not like that. Or the head of social media out here is not like that. These people are smart. I'm talking about the people who just go on and on, who listen to this stuff. I don't care if it's the Republicans or the Democrats. If President Obama stands up after just having come back from the Waldorf Astoria, raising $1.5 million for his campaign off his rich friends, and then makes a speech saying that the rich should pay more, you think they're going to wind up paying more? I don't think so. People really need to rise up. And by the way, speaking of rising up, I spoke to a guy the other day on another radio show, John Nichols. You want to read a really good book? Get a new book by the correspondent, the Washington correspondent of The Nation. His name is John Nichols, Nichols, Nichols. In fact, if you go to our Occupied Territory Facebook page, Occupied Territory Facebook, you will see a book review I wrote of two books that I urge you to read. One is by John Nichols, and it's called Uprising, and it's about how what happened in Madison, Wisconsin, when Scott Walker, the Koch puppet, decided to attack the unions over there. And now you see the recall vote in Wisconsin. It's a historical precedent. So many people signed a recall vote for this, you know, scurrilous little bastard, you know, who works for the Koch brothers. And so John Nichols' book called Uprising, which just came out about Madison, Wisconsin, and about Occupy and every other movement. And he's a true blue historian. He's a real solid historian. The other book is called Pity the Billionaire by Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank, who wrote The Wrecking Crew and What's the Matter with Kansas. And these are two books you should read. And if you want to get more information about them, obviously you can go check them out on Amazon. But take a look at our Facebook page, Occupied Territory on Facebook. Thomas Frank, Pity the Billionaire, and John Nichols, Uprising. Two books you should really read. I think that's about all I got to say today. It's time for me to go home and take a nap, because when I get some rest, then I'm able to monetize better. Okay, let's go to our theme. And there we go.